Hello and welcome to the final Jibe Talk in the Volvo Sailing Podcast for 2010. I'm Guy Swindles and we've a globe-trotting Christmas special for you. We're in Sydney to preview the Sydney to Hobart with Rob Mundell. We're in Barcelona as Amanda Blackley meets Pepe Rebeth ahead of the Barcelona World Race. We're in Minnesota to talk to ice yachting legend John Dennis. Now, how seasonal is that? And finally, we're in snowbound Britain to review 2010 and preview 2011 with Yachting World's Matt Sheehan. OK, let's wait no more for the Volvo Sailing Podcast news headlines. Everything's gearing up for the Sydney to Hobart, but part of the crew, one of the favourites, Ran, are being held up by snow in England. The race is on to get there in time. TP52 Hooligan, previously Emirates Team NZ, sees off all comers at the pre-Hobart Rolex Trophy rating race. Ben Ainslie leads a British 1-2-3 in the Finn in the opening round of the ISF Sailing World Cup, Sail Melbourne. And there was further British success for Nick Thompson in the Laser. Aussies Nico Della Carth and Nicholas Resch took the 49er title, and Matt Belcher and Mal Page the 470s. China's Zhang Dong Shuang won the Laser Radial, Hong Kong's Chang King Yin the men's windsurfers, and China's Swal Zhu the women's. A late port change in the Velux 5 Oceans, Punta de Este taking over from Salvador. And at the World Yacht Racing Forum, where all the great and good in sailing were gathered, with the unfortunate exception of your correspondent, the America's Cup announced the entry fee is to be slashed for the event. OK, it's off to Sydney now, where the voice, and indeed face for nearly 30 years, of the Sydney to Hobart, Rob Mundell, is readying himself for the big race. When I interviewed him, it was 6 in the morning in the UK, and my studio was surrounded by snow, it was still dark, and it was winter. So where did I find Mr. Mundell?
Well, Guy, I couldn't be in a better position right now. I'm on the 31st floor of the Intercontinental Hotel, right on the edge of Sydney Harbour. I'm looking at the Opera House, the Harbour Bridge, and right up the harbour to the Heads. It's a glorious summer day. Hardly a cloud in the sky. The sun's beginning to set, and it's about 28 degrees. So the stage is set right now, perfect sailing conditions, but the forecast we're getting this far out from the race that starts on Boxing Day is that the boys might have a bit of a bumpy ride down to Hobart this year.
No change there then, particularly. Now, just before we move on to the race itself, funnily enough, although the conditions there are beautiful, I know there have been stories of boats and crew members struggling to get to the race in time. Have most people made it now?
Well, I walked into the hotel here this morning, and who was the first person I saw but Sir Robin Knox Johnson? He's staying here as well. He's here. He's managed to escape London. The big concern is the crew of Ran, the winner of the Fastnet race, as you know. They look like they're going to make it. The report this morning was that they were struggling, but this afternoon it appears that they will get here on time, and everything's going to be okay for them. So they will start certainly one of the favourites for handicap honours in the race. So the big British hope it looks like it'll be race ready.
Now, Ran obviously is going to be one of the boats there or thereabouts. Who else should we look out for this year, Rob?
Definitely the two, well, they're near sister ships, is Loki, Stephen Ainsworth's boat, and Limit, Alan Briety from Perth. They are Reichel Pew designs, 63 feet long. Both very, very powerful boats, both very well prepared. Limit has just done a campaign through New Zealand and into the US. Ainsworth's Loki has won just about every race that matters on the East Coast here. They will be a big challenge as well. So if you had to pick the top three boats at the moment on form, they would be it. But then you've got to just look back to last year's Hobart race when a production boat, a Beneteau, won the race on corrected time. 628 nautical miles, anything can happen. But if you're a good boat, you've got a good chance.
Yes, I saw that when I saw an interview with the Ran owner before the race started, and that he said that's the joy of the race, is anybody can win the Sydney to Hobart on countback.
Absolutely. And see, this is a rare race, Guy, in as much as while it starts on Sydney Harbour, it's only a short run to the Heads and out to the open sea. It's a race of three stages down the New South Wales coast, then across Bass Strait, which can deal up anything, down the Tasmanian coast and across Storm Bay. But the race then finishes in the Derwent River, and it's about 11 nautical miles up the river, and that's where anything can happen. And over the 63 years of this race, it really has seen the race won and lost in the Derwent River many times.
Now, Rob, you've covered more than half the Fastnet races there have been. Do you still get the same buzz ahead of the start?
Guy, Hobart races, it's 35 or 36, I think, now that I've covered. I've sailed in three. It's always a buzz, primarily because of just the atmosphere here. When you look at it, with the harbour being such a brilliant amphitheatre, the cliffs, the beaches, the houses all around it, and the number of boats on the harbour, it's estimated that probably there's 300,000 people around here, either in their homes or on the shores or on the water watching it. And it just becomes this fantastic scene of the spectator boats escorting a fleet out of the harbour and then turning to the right, turning down south to head for Hobart. Every time it's a buzz, every time there's something just that little bit different, and it's always, there's always an element of excitement. This year, it looks like it could be the weather throwing a bit more excitement into it. But yeah, it's I don't think I've ever seen a Hobart race start where I said, God, that was boring.
Now, Rob, I can't let you leave on this occasion without mentioning one of your many talents is as a writer, and a book out this year, Bligh Master Mariner, which retells or tells the story properly, perhaps, of Captain Bligh of mutiny fame. Can you tell us a little bit about that before we have to sign off from Australia?
Guy, what I've done is gone out of my way to put the record straight. Sadly, Bligh has been totally maligned over 200 years, bad press, and certainly by four movies that have made him look like the tyrant, the cruel tyrant, and the cause of the mutiny. I've really worked hard to research the man as Master Mariner. I've looked at his entire naval career. Bligh was a genius. He was a great seafarer, a great navigator, explorer. He sailed with Captain Cook. He fought in battles, one battle in particular, Battle of Copenhagen, alongside Nelson. Amazing man, and nothing in the world of maritime history can match the launch voyage for 3,700 nautical miles and an open launch with 18 guys on board, including himself, and they all survived. Bligh was a genius. He was a great man. He wasn't the reason for the mutiny. It was because the mutineers wanted to go back to Tahiti to chase all those women that were throwing themselves at them. So, the book's gone remarkably well, hit number one here in Australia, and hopefully it'll be on sale in the UK and around the world very soon.
Well, I checked it out. You can get it on Amazon, so do if you're listening to this. Terrific read from Rob Mundellan. Rob, hopefully we'll catch up with you in the new year, hear how Sydney to Hobart went, and catch up on all the rest of the sailing news down under.
Thanks, Guy. I'll look forward to that, and all the best to everyone for Christmas and the new year.
A Boxing Day start for the Sydney to Hobart, while we'll have a New Year's Eve beginning for the Barcelona World Race. Two Volvo race veterans, reporter and great friend of the podcast, Amanda Blackley, and Amersport, Telefonica, and Movistar bowman Pepe Ribes met to talk about the race. Pepe's with Alex Payer aboard Estrella Dam.
Right, first of all, congratulations. Tell me how you're feeling about being a father.
Thank you, Amanda. I feel very good. It's been an unbelievable experience in my life, that probably is one of the best experiences in my life. And for Sandra as well, it's been amazing. So now I don't know what is going to happen from now. Everything is new, so we'll see.
And obviously you've been involved with this project since the end of the last Volvo. How do you feel that the day is almost there? You're nearly ready to start the Barcelona World Race.
It's amazing, but looks very far away, the last Volvo for me. I think it was 4 days later we finished the Volvo, I step on this boat in Lorient. And it's been 18 months, just unbelievable. A lot of races, a lot of miles, a lot of classes. I come back to classes. It's been a long time since I've been in a class, but I have learned so many things in all different areas, in like being in a Volvo boat in your position, you learn, or your area of responsibility is very narrow. And being in one of these projects, in double-handed, your area of responsibility is 100% of the project. So it's been like going to the university for me. It's been an amazing 18 months that I learned so much. I get involved with so much different people in weather, learning systems, learning. So it's like being in the university.
And your relationship with Alex also goes back a long way. So how are you working together, and how do you feel your chances are against the rest of the fleet?
Well, with Alex, it's been nearly perfect. I mean, first time that we planned to do this, we were training in Alicante with the Volvo before the last Volvo. So it was the first meeting that Alex and I had for, say, hey, we want to do this, let's look for money, let's look for a team to do this. And it's been a very good relationship. We are different, very different characters. He comes from the single-handed world. I come from the crew world. But the mix, I think, it's a very good mix. And both we were, I will say, learners. Like, both we start this project in a very low, very low level compared to the other boats. And I think we build up all our skills together. So it's been a very good project, and we are waiting for the date of the start. I mean, we've been working so hard for 18 months. We sailed, I think it's 32,000 miles to be here in the start to now. And we think we are prepared. And obviously, you never know when you go to the ocean, no? And when you are going to go 100 days. In the Volvo, you go 20 days, and 100 things happens in 20 days. But here, we are going to go 100 days, so 1,000 things are going to happen in 100 days, no? A little mistake and you lose, you have to go home. A little mistake in a maneuver, or a little mistake in a squall or something, and your race is finished. But I think we love both sailing, and this is going to be a great race for us.
And how do you see the rest of your competition? It's a pretty spectacular fleet, really.
Yes, well, I think very, as you say, very spectacular fleet. Some new boats with, I think, the best French sailors at the moment, or at least for me, they are the best French sailors with the newest Imoca boats. So I think we have a lot of respect for them. I know what it takes to sail the Vendée, what it takes. We've been sailing for so long, so I have a lot of respect for them. I am amazed every time that I see one of the new boats. So the areas, as a lot of areas that they develop that no one else is developing, like in a Volvo is a closed rule, here is an open rule. So everyone is trying his boat to be the fastest. So there's a lot of new things in the new boat. There's a lot of new things you can develop all the time. And they are very good sailors, very skilled. So a lot of respect for all the sailors here. But then we have like the Spanish league, so so we want to win the Spanish league.
And you've also got a little bit of pressure in the fact that Alex is from here, and this is your adopted city.
Yes,
it's quite an important thing for you to be leaving Barcelona and arriving in Barcelona. A little bit of pressure there from the city, I imagine, too.
I'll tell you one thing: leaving Barcelona, I don't mind how we are going to be. We can leave one day later, as Michel did in the Vendée. Will be very important how we come back to Barcelona, no? But I mean, it's very cool for me, and it's been very good for my wife and to be here in Barcelona for so long. We've been so many years away, living in all around the world, and it's very good for Sandra. It's been very good for the family. And pressure? No, we've been sailing, we've been training, we have prepared the race. And we are going to do the best that we can. And that will be Alex, and that will be me, and that will be the Estrella Damm team. We are very lucky to have the local sponsor, as well, the local beer, as a sponsor, which is like playing in Barcelona, living in Barcelona. So, I mean, it's been very close to be a very perfect campaign. We just need to finish. So we'll fight very hard to finish and to finish as high as possible.
Last question. You always say to me, I just want to go now. I just want to leave. It's too long. But I imagine now being a dad and having to say goodbye to your little one, that's going to be pretty difficult.
I think that when we run out of food in the Volvo boat, Bowie always tell me, the hungry wolf runs faster. So I want to leave because I want to come back as soon as possible to see my child now.
That's a really good motivation.
It's the Christmas and New Year Volvo Sailing Podcast, jibe talking, and what better way to really get going with the festive spirit than talk about a very different kind of sailing, ice boating. And I'm delighted to say we're talking to one of the leading practitioners, John Dennis, for this edition of the podcast. And John, a little bit about ice boating. How did it come about? What do you do?
Well, the ice sailing at one time was the fastest way to travel. The boats travel on skates that are sharpened to a point, and which offer very low resistance, and then they have sails, of course. And there used to be stern steers, and then that has evolved into some one design classes that we now race. And the boat that we race, that I race in particular, is called a BN ice boat.
Now, how does rigging one of these boats, say, differ from going out on the ocean wave?
It's the boat is 12 feet long, 8 feet wide, and on three runners, so you're actually walking on ice instead of, you know, water. And it's cat rigged, so it has one sail and a 16-foot tall rotating mast.
Okay. Now, from what I understand, you don't spend all your time on the ice. I was looking around at some of the descriptions of the event, and people talking about flying about a foot above the ice.
Yeah, you actually lay on your back in the boat, and there's a tiller that turns the front runner, and you steer with your hand. So your head is about a foot above the ice, and you're kind of looking over your toes at where you're going.
So how big is the sport now, John?
We probably have, I personally probably attend 6 regattas a year, and a world's event, you plan on about 200 boats, 200 entrants, and the world's alternates between the European and the North American continent.
I have to ask, how do you fit 200 boats on ice? Where can you possibly do that?
You sail in 55 boat fleets, and there's a gold fleet, a silver fleet, a bronze fleet, and an aluminum fleet. And it's based on qualifications, and there are some qualifiers that you can qualify up. So you only race 55 boats at a time.
Only. Okay, what's it like
when
you've got 54 other ice boats hurtling around you, lying down on a great lake somewhere?
At some times, the first weather mark does look a little bit like the first turn in a motocross race. It can be a little bit exciting.
A little bit. What got you into it, John? How did you get into that side of racing, if you like, sailing?
You know, for me, I've raced sailboats my entire life, and my father, very maybe 7 years old, he brought home two what were called Lockley Skimmer ice boats, and they're little ice boats and very fun to sail and reasonably inexpensive, and that's when we started, and it just kind of grew from there.
So how have you, is the season over? Is there a mid-season lull because of when the weather's at its worst? How does the season work, John?
Well, the biggest thing is we need clear ice to sail on. So we're always looking for new freeze. It happens to be snowing in Minnesota right as we speak, and so our sailing here will be no more. and then maybe Iowa, or maybe even Southern Illinois, something like that. So the boats are in a trailer. When we have local sailing, we sail as much as we can to train, and then when that's gone, we travel.
Well, if the season's finished, the last I saw in a communication, you were lying fifth in the overall championship. How did you get on in the end?
Well, the fifth is a ranking. That's an international ranking.
Okay.
And that's how we qualify for which fleet, and it's based on a continental or higher regatta place, and we just concluded the Western Region Regatta on Lake Winnebago this weekend.
How'd you get on?
That was a fantastic event. We sailed 7 races. Great wind, and I was fortunate enough to win that one, so that was fun.
Well, John, congratulations. I'm really glad you went out on a high this season, just leads me to a final question, really. How do you now prepare until everything ices up again?
Well, the World Championships is in 3 weeks. Well, it's the last week in January, actually, so it's a little longer than that. And where it'll be sailed is not determined yet. What will happen is that the event is scheduled for the last week of January. The site will be determined the week before. So wherever there's a clear lake in North America, that's where we will go to sail that World Championship. So it's kind of an odd sport that way, in that the time that we sail is scheduled, but the place that we sail varies depending on the conditions. So the season isn't really over. It's just over in this particular place.
Okay, for our Christmas and New Year podcast, well, it really wouldn't be complete without a chat with Matt Sheehan, of course, the technical editor of Yachting World, and the man who's kept us informed from all corners of the globe over the past year, and I trust will do so again next year. Matt, what I thought probably we should do in this final edition for 2010 is look back at the last year and look forward to 2011. Now, I suppose 2010, really, if you're starting it would be February with the America's Cup.
I think you're absolutely right, Guy. I mean, it was an extraordinary event, and not only because of the two weapons that set to at each other when the racing actually got underway, but of course because of all the uncertainty in the build-up to that. I mean, within just weeks of that event, still no one knew whether it was going to happen or not. Was it on? Was it off? Was it going to happen? But in the end, of course, we now know it did. And it was an extraordinary event. But I think one of the really interesting... Well, two things that are really interesting. One is that extraordinary event triggered one of the biggest changes, if not the biggest change, that the America's Cup has ever seen. We've yet to actually see it played out, but the future is, as we know, multi-hulls, wing masts, and it's a pretty big, bold step. The other thing that's interesting about it is that the Cup actually had a big knock-on effect for a number of other key racing circuits. Things like the TP52 circuit down in the Mediterranean. There were a lot of Cup teams were practicing and training and building up their routines, their communications within teams and the rest of it within the TP52 racing. They've now, those teams, a lot of them have now said, right, we've got to concentrate on multi-hulls, which looked like it was going to leave the TP52s quite exposed. Another class has been the Extreme 40s, of course, the catamarans. People are now have been looking at them very carefully and thinking, right, maybe next year, for anybody who's got a Cup aspiration, the Extreme 40 is the boat to be on. So they're sort of waiting for this flood of Cup sailors maybe to come over and brace themselves, perhaps. World Match Racing Tour, another major event that has felt the repercussions of the big changes in America's Cup. They had to look at themselves and say, well, we could have been the training ground for America's Cup sailors. Are we going to be that anymore. What's going to happen to us? Is everybody, are all the top players suddenly going to leave? And then, of course, another event that isn't necessarily affected by the America's Cup, but it's certainly a big issue for the sailors that are involved with it, is the Olympics. Some people like Ian Percy, Ben Ainslie are the first two that spring to mind, but there are many others who wanted to be involved with the America's Cup, but actually saw a clash between that and the Olympics. So it's been it was a very interesting year, and I think when you look back at it, a few months down the line, you see that actually what has actually happened is that there's actually been a big reshuffle with these major events, and some pretty interesting news for next year and the way that they are then going to run. So we have the TP52 circuit has actually seen a number of new teams come in, some new boats being built, some new names, and it looks very exciting because, you know, the order has been reshuffled. The Extreme 40s announced a 9-show event season. So they've got 9 events next year. That looks like it's going to kick off pretty well. The World Match Racing Tour, they've announced new events and new venues for next season. So there's been it's been an interesting year, triggered by one extraordinary event in February.
That's 2010, and you've started to look at 2011. Obviously, the shake-up, we'll see what occurs in the fallout from the America's Cup into all the other tours going on, all the other events and regattas. But looking ahead at 2011 with your Mystic Meg head on, Matt, or Mystic Matt, perhaps, what are you seeing in your crystal ball?
Well, my crystal ball actually starts just a couple of days before 2011 actually gets underway, because, of course, on Boxing Day, it's the start of the Sydney Hobart, the annual race down to Hobart, so we'll be watching very carefully that, because that's always quite an exciting race to watch. And of course, right at the end of the year, of course, is the start of the Barcelona World Race, the two-handed round the world race, so that starts on New Year's Eve. And then we roll into 2011 proper, and I guess in February, of course, we've got the Extreme 40s. They're kicking off the first, as I say, their first of 9 events. That kicks off in Muscat. That's going to be fascinating. There's going to be some big names popping up there. There's going to be some people, I'm sure, that we didn't expect to see, just going to find out what multi-hull sailing is all about. But I guess it's not all about pro sailing, of course. One of the other very interesting events that's picking up is the Royal Ocean Racing Club's Caribbean 600, a 600-mile race around the Caribbean in February. What could be better than that? Offshore sailing in T-shirt and shorts. Little surprise that event has actually become more and more popular. So that's going to be a very interesting one to look at. And then when we get to the middle of the year, the other events that sort of stand out for me, again, whilst talking about the Royal Ocean Racing Club, they have a transatlantic race that actually kicks off in June. That's going to be one to watch, because that's going to be a very interesting mix of professionals and amateurs. Of course, the unmistakable America's Cup in its new guise is supposed to get underway in June with the America's Cup World Series, the 45-footers with solid wing masts. There's going to be plenty of attention focused on them. And, of course, talking about attention being focused on people, it's Sail for Gold in Weymouth, the Olympic Classes event, which has proved to be incredibly popular over the years. Well, of course, that's going to be looked at even more closely next year, because that will be one of the major events as we step towards the 2012 Olympics. And, in fact, it's a double billing, or a double helping, if you like, for next year, because actually come August, then there's the Olympic test event proper. So there are two major Olympic events going on next year. So that's going to attract a lot of attention. Then there's some special birthdays. There's lots of them, but the two that stick out for me, one is the Round the Island. That celebrates its 80th birthday. Would you believe it? 80 times around the Isle of Wight. And a boat, a very successful and popular boat, celebrates 100 years next year. And that's the International Star Class. It'll be interesting because that's one of the classes that is looking like it's under a bit of pressure for the 2016 Olympics. So it's going to be a bittersweet year, or could be a bittersweet year next year for the Star. So expect to hear lots about that. It's a Fastnet year, of course. That always brings in plenty of people, plenty of attention. But of course, at the end of the year, one of the biggest events to round off the end of the year, we've got, of course, the Volvo Ocean Race starts in November. And again, it's almost like a double helping for people who like the Volvo Ocean Race, because we've got the Volvo Legends Regatta, and that is going to be fascinating. That's already been billed as being similar to what the America's Cup Jubilee was, the America's Cup, for the Volvo Ocean Race. And of course, there's the Volvo Ocean Race, as we know, steeped in history, fascinating boats, amazing people, great stories. It's a bit of a bumper year, Guy.
Okay, that's it for 2010. Join us again bright and early in January for the next edition of Jibe Talkin'. In the meantime, remember to check in at regular intervals to www.volvooceanrace.com, and have a wonderful Christmas and a splendid new year.